This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of my 2009 conversation with Trudier Harris and the late Noel Polk. The conversation was a preview of a debate on the topic, what was the most influential Southern novel of the 20th century, which aired on SCETV's Take on the South. This encore is a part of our continuing series, Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
With me in the studio today are two friends and colleagues in Southern Studies. Professor Trudier Harris is J. Carlisle Citizen, Professor of English and Comparative Literature at UNC Chapel Hill. And Dr. Noel Polk is Professor Emeritus, Mississippi State University in Starkville, Mississippi. And first of all, Trudier and Noel, I want to welcome you to the journal.
Thank you so much.
Thanks
it's good
very
to be
much.
Here.
It is. Our topic today is going to be, what was the most influential novel written in the 20th century South? Not about the South, but written by a Southern author. And you both contributed to a list. I'm just briefly going to run down that list for our listeners. The list, and this is in alphabetical order, not in any kind of preference. Absalom, Absalom by William Faulkner. All the King's Men, Robert Penn Warren. Beloved by Toni Morrison, Cain by Jean Toomer, Deliverance by James Dickey, Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, Invisible Man by Ralph Allison, Look Homeward, Angel by Thomas Wolfe, Native Son by Richard Wright, Roots by Alex Haley, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman by Ernest J. Gaines, The Klansman by Thomas Dixon, Jr., The Color Purple by Alice Walker, The Heart is a Lonely Hunter by Carson McCullers, The Last Gentleman by Walker Percy, The Sound and the Fury by William Faulkner, Their Eyes Were Watching God by Zora Neale Hurston, To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee, Tobacco Road by Erskine Caldwell, and Wise Blood by Flannery O'Connor. That's quite a selection, range of literature. That includes much from the early part of the 20th century. Toomer wrote in the 20s.
1923 is Cain.
Is Cain. So that, I think that may be the earliest book on the list.
The Klansman.
I'm sorry, The Klansman.
Yeah.
But I've had people call in and say, where's Ellen Glasgow? Where is Shirley Ann Grau? I mean, there are lots of people who might be in here. They're also, in terms of contemporary writers, not that many made the list. And this list, by the way, folks, was assembled by the Southern Studies faculty at USC, six members of the faculty, a variety of disciplines, and with Professor Harris and Professor Polk's input. So it's a pretty broad section of folks who have read Southern letters from graduate school days to the present. The most influential novel, Southern novel of the 20th century. Trudier, how do you look at the term influential when you're looking at this list of books?
I think there's several ways you can look at it, and we have our different ways of doing so. Influence in terms of who's buying the books, who's reading the books. Influence in terms of how frequently the book may be taught in a particular classroom. Influence, for example, you have Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man on there, and that book just happened to be about 1965, voted the best novel that had been published in the past 20 years or so. So if judgment is being made by a group of editors or reviewers, you have that kind of influence. Influence in terms of the general public, who's reading. You know, granting agencies usually refer to the out-of-school adult. What is the out-of-school adult a reading? And also influence in terms of who's responding to your list and who's voluntarily offering up particular titles.
Mm-hmm. No. Yeah, I agree with all of that, and those kinds of lists and opinions are functions of the time and place, and maybe what somebody had for breakfast that morning, or what he or she had most recently read of Southern, and I think there's plenty of slippage with the term influence. Mm-hmm. In one way, Erskine Caldwell has done more to influence the way American culture has read the South over the years than any other book on that list.
You mean the Hillbilly South, the Dukes of Hazzard, the Snuffy Smith comic strips, Little Abner.
The incest in clay floored cabins, as Faulkner put it once, that kind of thing, poor, ignorant, wisecracking. and so forth. Yeah.
Malnourished.
Malnourished.
Lazy.
So you're talking about in media influence, what kind of television shows grow out of particular literary ventures or stereotypes? Or
Sure. I think that Caldwell's Tobacco Road and God's Little Acre probably did a lot to set a tone for the way we actually have seen the South over the years, especially early on.
But I mean, of course, you've got it since that we're talking about media influence. The counterbalance to the Tobacco Road South is Margaret Mitchell's Gone with the Wind South. I mean, both Hollywood stereotypes, right? I mean,
right, absolutely.
To some extent, yeah. It's a great romantic love affair with things Southern, a great nostalgia for days gone by. I think that keeps Gone with the Wind afloat. I mean, the North Carolina affair, you can go in and get into your 19th century Southern belle kind of garb with a floppy hat, with the those images that Margaret Mitchell put forth in Gone with the Wind. And I think there's a sort of longing for those good old times when folks could sit around and have their mint juleps brought to them and their lands worked and they didn't have to worry about a whole lot. And even when they did, there were ways that they could imagine those good old days coming again.
We are all more or less of the same generation. So at least we knew that film was around. In the 21st century, having dealt with undergraduates at the University of South Carolina, not a lot of them have seen the movie Gone with the Wind.
And that may be a good thing.
I guess growing up as a white Southerner, you know, my granddad took me to see it when it came out again, reissued in the early 50s, went to the downtown theater in Mobile and to see Gone with the Wind. You know, it was a big deal. But there's another book on the list, which was an award-winning movie, and that's To Kill a Mockingbird, which portrays a very different South from Tobacco Road, although there's some of those kind of characters in there.
And they're marginalized, or the source of all that's bad. Mm-hmm. Not all, but they're the ones who actually do the evil deeds and are distrusted by the community, who probably share some of the values of those folks, but they do it in a more genteel way, which is a more insidious because less visible kind of racism at bottom.
Well, I think. A novel like To Kill a Mockingbird also, well, Tobacco Road would do this as well. When you talk about small town South, when you talk about relationships, when you talk about people interacting with each other, you know, for example, after Atticus defends Tom Robinson and the black folks in the community bring the food, or earlier on when the Cunninghams, who cannot pay during the Depression era with money, actually bring the nuts or the small bunches of greens that they can to repay deeds that have been performed for them. So I think that there is, and that to some extent might be a kind of nostalgia as well, but it's a different kind of nostalgia and perhaps one that a larger percentage, a portion of the public can identify with because the sort of Margaret Mitchell plantation home South, it's not one that the majority of folks nowadays would have been had ancestors who were privy to, whereas something like Macomb, Alabama is more on the radar perhaps of a larger number of folks in the country.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of my 2009 conversation with Trudier Harris and the late Noel Polk. The conversation was a preview of a debate on the topic, what was the most influential Southern novel of the 20th century, which aired on SCETV's Take on the South. This encore is a part of our continuing series, Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
Well, you know, I was just in another context dealing with, again, a colleague in movies, a small town America between the wars, you know, brings back to mind things like It's a Wonderful Life and community interaction. You know, that small town in Alabama certainly was no haven, but those small acts of kindness and neighborliness mm-hmm. and community that you mentioned, Trudier, is something somebody in Indiana probably could relate to.
It's a different South, a kindlier South than we had from Caldwell and Faulkner and others who are looking at those sorts of issues similarly. What I really like about To Kill a Mockingbird, what I like about what it does is that it draws on that old Gothic tradition which posits some kind of horrible secret in the family mansion or in the house. And what it does is expose, I mean, this is Boo, who personifies all that secret and mysterious and fearsome in the Southern Gothic, and what the novel does is to allow that secret out, to explain the secret that it's not incest or any of those other kinds of things that we associate with the Gothic, but he really is a kindly person who is very, very shy and who actually saves Scout and Jim from a fate worse than death, as it were, pulls them out. And I really like that because it suggests without preaching that there those secrets, all of those secrets need to be explored, need to be allowed out in.
So it domesticates the Gothic.
Very nicely put. Yes, it does. It does.
Well,
it de-horrifies it somehow.
Yeah, it de-horrifies it. It turns it into its own kind of innocence. And as you say, when Boo Radley is finally out and Scout sees him and sees the consequences of that isolation on him for all those years, she's very sensitive to that and very sympathetic to that. And it's not something that's scary anymore at all.
Right. Well, when the novel came out, and I have seen things you've written, Trudy, about it, and the fact is the African-American individuals are real characters in To Kill a Mockingbird. They're not cardboard stereotypes. Mm-hmm. There is a black household help within Atticus Finch's household, but she's not a mammy.
She is not a mammy. And not only is she not a mammy, but she does not speak in dialect in that household. When you think about some of the films out of the 1930s and the representations of black female characters, especially the mammy characters, and it's like their world, their linguistic worlds are miles away from where the white characters are. And one of the distinctive things about To Kill a Mockingbird is that Calpurnia is somebody who knows how to code switch. She can speak one way in that household with Scout and Atticus and Jim, and another way when she goes home to her own community and to the church. And the fact that Harper Lee recognized that and built in that trait, I think, is something quite different. And the same thing in terms of Tom Robinson and how he's portrayed. Here is a man who's just not just guttural and oomphing and making noises. Here is not somebody who is afraid to the extent that he can't say, yes, this young white lady did invite me into the house. Yes, she did kiss me. Yes, she made the approaches. And we know the kind of pressure he's under from the community to say otherwise. And he stands up for that. And I think that's for himself as best he can under the circumstances. And I think that's pretty admirable. That's not so stereotypical. Although, I have to admit that, whereas you were taken to see Gone with the Wind, I don't think that in my generation we were generally, as teenagers, aware of Harper Lee and To Kill a Mockingbird and dashing off to the movies to see that in the same way.
In the Birmingham in which you grew up.
Tuscaloosa.
If there were a theater that allowed you to go into it, you'd have been in the balcony.
We did have one black theater in Tuscaloosa. And the fascinating thing about that is that they weren't going to bring To Kill a Mockingbird or Gone with the Wind to that theater. We saw what the majority of American teenagers would have had access to in terms of Westerns, in terms of newsreels, in terms of cartoon, those kinds of things, for which we paid the handsome sum of like 5 Pepsi-Cola bottle tops to go to the movie on Saturday. And we did not sit in the back room. So it was segregation that enabled a certain level of, dare I say, dignity. You didn't have to sit in the balcony, but you were in a black segregated theater.
Well, in Mobile, there were 2 black theaters on the Avenue, Jefferson Davis Avenue. It was just referred to as the Avenue. But there was one theater, the Sanger Theater, had a balcony for African-American patrons. The rest of them were segregated.
Yeah.
So, and Noel, I forgot, where did you grow up?
Picayune, Mississippi.
Did you even have a movie theater in
Picayune?
We did.
We actually had two of them for a while, both run by the same person, but a fairly wide selection popular movies. Mm-hmm. I was stunned, actually, when the Defiant ones showed, that picture of the black and white man, Tony Curtis, and I forget who, escape handcuffed together, and they have to make do. And they in the world they're trying to escape from, and they become friends, of course. And there's a sacrifice, and it's all nicely redemptive and everything in ways that should have made Mississippi mad. But there it was, right there in Picayune, Mississippi.
Well, that it might not have made them mad because look, there's still the glamour of Hollywood.
True.
Did you have African American patrons in those theaters?
Yes.
So, was that a balcony?
In the balcony, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And a separate entrance, too, around the corner.
I don't know if about your students, Trudy, but I can talk about things like this to my classes in American history now. And they just don't fathom the idea of the separate entrance, the balcony, the separate water fountains, it's just something that's so foreign to them.
Yeah, when you talk about, when I speak of racial difficulties in the South, generally my students say, oh, Dr. Harris, that was in your time. You sound like my grandmother. And they have this mistaken assumption that because they went to integrated schools or attended integrated schools and were friendly or friends with lots of non-black students that we don't have a problem anymore. So, yeah, it's very difficult to get them to see these kinds of things. But then you don't have to think just from the time we were in school and our current students. I mean, think about the lives of people like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Mm-hmm. And think about when the movie Malcolm X came out. Mm-hmm. Some people were interpreting it as Malcolm 10.
Well, the South that is represented on this list, I think every book on the list has got sometimes not just road bumps, but they've got the bridges blown up, too.
It's true.
Well, they have. And for most of the texts on the list, they're not worlds in which race is absent.
No.
It's central in almost all of those texts. Well, there are some that don't treat it directly. But implicitly, it might be there. I'm thinking specifically of Alice Walker's The Color Purple, for example. And in some ways, you could talk about that being an intra within African-American community novel. But you could probably find along the edges some sense of that racial consideration. Mm-hmm. But it's central to most of the texts that are truly Southern novels and written by Southerners. Mm-hmm. I think there are some novels on that list that don't fit as comfortably into the designation of the others. For example, Native Son, Invisible Man, and Beloved. Mm-hmm. It's surprising to some extent that they are on the list.
Well, of course, Wright being a Southerner, but Native Son's set somewhere else. I mean, it's
set in Chicago, and there's like a one paragraph mention, perhaps, of the fact that these folks migrated from Mississippi. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's a clash of race in the South. I mean, in the North, in the Chicago area.
Yeah, I think black characters are conspicuously absent, pretty much, from all the King's Men. Mm-hmm. There's just not much of a black presence or concern, which is semi surprising to me.
And certainly, in from Deliverance, I. Which made the list.
Really? Local talent.
Local talent. In terms of local talent, I would have gone with Julia Peterkin.
Mm-hmm. It's surprising to think that she won the Pulitzer Prize for Literature in 1928, 29, somewhere thereabouts.
The book was 28, I think, and Scarlet Sister Mary, and I think the prize was in 29.
Yeah, Scarlet Sister Mary. I mean, that's just a classic sort of black-white South thing when you think about that. And it's also a great testament to what happens to books that win the Pulitzer Prize, that go off reading lists or off teaching lists, and are just generally forgotten. Right. When I mention that text these days, Nobody's ever heard of it, and certainly nobody's read it.
Well, what is interesting, though, in anthropological circles, she is having something of a renaissance.
Right.
Based upon, since all of our writing pretty much is based upon experience and observation.
Yeah.
I would say that it disappeared. I mean, there was a book that was transformed into sort of into a Broadway production, which was an absolute disaster.
Sarah Bernhardt in blackface.
Yes. By the way, Miss Peterkin was very irate that she wanted a black cast.
Yes.
But you know, she'd sold the rights, so, and of course that it didn't last very long on Broadway. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the looming figure. Noel, this author you studied most of your life, that's William Faulkner. There are two of his books on the list, Absalom, Absalom, and Sound and the Fury. He started off with Sound and the Fury, and of course the rest of that is signifying nothing. What was he trying to do?
He set about to do what Wallace Stevens described in his poem of Modern Poetry. He set about to create a new stage. Find a new language for talking about things that the traditional narrative and traditional language just simply were not capable of describing adequately. Mm-hmm. And this problem increased as the 20th century grew older and older. And the sort of question writers of his generation were facing was how does traditional language, traditional narrative help us say something worthy of things like racism, like the Civil War, like lynching, genocide, the Holocaust, all of these horrible things, which to a certain extent, once you try to put them in traditional language, about the best you can come up with is a kind of banal, how awful. And that doesn't seem adequate to help us experience or understand the outrage that those kinds of things caused in the 20th century.
Well, I think the fact that you have two Faulkner novels on the list is a testament to the influence of the Academy. You know, we sometimes think that academics don't have very much influence out there in the real world at all. But having had scores of generations of students read Faulkner, be required to read Faulkner, and have him on lists for English majors, on lists for students who are getting master's degrees and who are doing doctoral examinations, is a testament to this appeal that he has in terms of treating subjects that have historically been crucial to the South, but also the way in which he treats those subjects and the way in which students and scholars are challenged to enter into those texts. And I think all those things have influenced his staying power in the Academy. Once he was rediscovered, because for a while there, weren't the majority of his books out of print?
In the late 40s, this is true. He went for actually 7 years without publishing a book for the first time in a decade and a half. And I basically agree with you, except that his influence on non-American readers, his influence throughout the world, the French, for example, began reading and translating him big time in the 30s, and he was a central figure in the French Renaissance. He was read by a lot of folks in that the French Resistance, mm-hmm. Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus read him and brought him out of that experience in order and helped to create probably the most profound philosophy of the middle 20th century, existentialism, as they described it and wrote about it. And the Latin American writers, Carlos Fuentes and Gabriel yes. Garcia Marquez, were reading him and translating him and writing learned essays about him in reviews a good deal before he actually got adopted by the Academy in this country.
And that's really a commentary on what happens in a lot of instances in terms of Europeans valuing our artists. Mm-hmm. And writers much sooner than we do. Even Shakespearean actors mm-hmm. who played in Poland and who were so well received there American Shakespearean actors before they were recognized in the United States. And once it seems that that stamp of approval from across the water sometimes get placed on writers or artists in the United States, then we fall into line. But on the other hand, I guess it's good that we fell into line in this instance.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of my 2009 conversation with Trudier Harris and the late Noel Polk. The conversation was a preview of a debate on the topic, what was the most influential Southern novel of the 20th century, which aired on SCETV's Take on the South. This encore is a part of our continuing series, Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
There are curious scholarly responses to all that. There are plenty of people who will allow scholars to write about Moby Dick without ever having been on a whaling ship. But especially in the early days of Faulkner, the Faulkner boom in the 60s and 70s, there were people outside of the South who didn't think they could write about Faulkner without actually visiting the South. And that most often came to spending a weekend in Atlanta or Birmingham. Birmingham or something ridiculous like that. But the South is apparently a more exotic place than a whaling ship. And so there was some kind of need to explore it on its own. People felt you couldn't understand Faulkner unless you actually went to Oxford.
It's really strange. It sounds like the same kind of arguments that people were making in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s about studying African-American literature. Like, how can I write about a black writer? I'm not black. Well, Dag, for how many centuries have you been writing about Shakespeare?
Exactly.
You ain't British either, but
exactly.
You've been doing that. So it's sort of a false qualification that people think you need or prerequisite in order to get into this. And I think, you know, as long as scholars have their interpretive powers, I mean, that's what we rely on, you know, our minds to give us access to these things.
What the French and the foreigners did was precisely to recognize Faulkner's mind at work.
Mm-hmm.
So many of the reviewers, for lots of political reasons, assuming that if something that extraordinary came out of Mississippi, that there was something freakish about it, no good could come out of Mississippi. And so they had to explain it somehow. Edmund Wilson reviewed Intruder in the Dust by way of saying, well, it's a fair for a guy from Mississippi, but he would have been a lot better novelist if he had spent more time in New York talking to people like me, like Edmund Wilson.
Yeah, so Faulkner is far ahead of his critics then in terms of what he's capable of doing and achieving then.
Yes, absolutely. And there's always been a sense in talking about Southern literature, this whole notion of place and the significance of place, which comes out of Eudora Welty, who never said that place was any more than one of the angels that watch over fiction. There was some kind of sense that if a Southern writer wasn't sitting barefooted with his or her feet actually on the Mississippi mud, that they couldn't write.
There we're back to Tobacco Road again.
Exactly. We're back to Tobacco Road. Exactly.
Well, we're back to generalized stereotypes about
exactly,
the South.
Exactly, yes.
Precisely.
Yes.
But you mentioned the Europeans, and I've done a lot of corresponding with our colleagues at Bonn and Vienna, Odense, and there the American studies programs, the literary portions of those are basically Southern literature.
that's true.
Lothar Heunighausen at the University of Bonn, who's just retired, was a Faulkner scholar. Jan Gretland is still active in contemporary Southern writers at Odense. And Waldemar Zakharowicz at the University of Vienna is into early 20th century Southern writing. And they're very strong programs.
And they're now discovering Eudora Welty, who is not on that list, but who is an extraordinary writer, and we're just now discovering how extraordinary.
She's one of Gretland's favorites right now.
Yes. Yeah, we had a Polish scholar who came over to Chapel Hill a few years ago, who is a Eudora Welty person, very much interested in her. Also, you have to, I think, in part put that in the context of the generalized interest in a global South or in globalization, period, but especially the global South. And if you think about what part of the country fascinates of the United States fascinates people from the outside. As you were saying earlier, as one of you said earlier, this whole exotic thing and the exoticism that's there. And why haven't you people ever reconciled all of these strange trends of things that happen in the South and this history that you find so burdensome? Why haven't you reconciled that in some way? So I'm not sure that I could put my finger exactly on what the fascination is, but I agree that scholars throughout the world have had this fascination.
Well, I think you said the magic word, exotic. I have actually had colleagues from Europe talk about, and particularly when we've had them over here to South Carolina, they think South Carolina is especially exotic, much more so than Mississippi, because they think about the Mississippi mud. But, you know, you've got places like Charleston and Beaufort, and they're just, well, they're certainly more Caribbean. You know, we are the link with a different world than most of the rest of the country.
But part of the interest is from countries in what we call the post-colonial world, people who are coming out from under oppressors. Well, one of the interests that the Latin American writers had in Faulkner was a kind of shared history or symmetrical history with the American South. Japanese people, when Faulkner visited there in the mid-50s, suggested that one of the reasons they were interested in his work was that they had just recently been defeated in a war. And Faulkner wrote about responses to defeat and so forth. So I think that there's a kind of shared history in a lot of these countries of war and defeat, famine, and all these things that Faulkner writes about that renders him, at least to them, less exotic than simply central, as Carlos Fuentes said about Faulkner. He's essential to us because he showed us how to write our way through the baggage of custom and language that our oppressors had handed to us for these generations and liberated us intellectually, spiritually, and if not politically, but gave them a way of talking about their history that was not controlled by the oppressor's language.
But that's really interesting, though, because when you think about Faulkner and his position in the American South and oppression or oppressors, he would be identified with one of the oppressors, would he not, in this case? And so if he's the one who's giving them that entree into all of that, it's a fascinating kind of...
Well, I think that they recognized that he was, in fact, not, through his books, that he was not one of the oppressors, that, mm-hmm. that he was... he understood history as a construct that is always written in favor of the oppressor. And he was teaching us, whether we knew it or not, how to get around that somehow and talk about how things really are so that we don't accept mm-hmm. history as being a coherent history as being a capital T truth that we must have allegiance to. So I think they recognized him as really subversive in ways that we did not. American critics continued to think about Faulkner as rewriting, perhaps with slightly better language, Erskine Caldwell. And that simply was not true. And the Europeans especially recognized that.
Well, one thing I'm already struck by in reading Faulkner, when you talk about people, you mentioned earlier how folks said, oh, gee, how could he possibly have come out of the South with what he's doing? So there must be something special or different or whatever. And I've been to his home in Oxford, Mississippi, and looked at all the writings on the walls. And I'm always struck by how he managed to keep all of those bits of any narrative in his head as he was putting the books together. And especially in something like Absalom, I mean, how many ways can you look at a blackbird? Because that story is fairly simple. If you just said, okay, this happened, that happened, that. Here are the facts of the history. And then you start putting the pieces together. This person knows this person knows that. This person maybe knows a little bit. When is this fact going to be revealed? What's the relationship here? And it goes on and on and on. So I have to respect that. It's incredible.
It was incredible. And he actually put Absalom away for about 6 months and wrote a novel called Pylon in between. He said Absalom had become inchoate, even for him. And he wrote a very modern novel in between, and then was able to come back and finish Absalom.
And does anybody remember Pylon?
Yes.
Probably not. They remember it, but not read it.
Well, the French have been interested in Pylon, and so that gives me some sense that there may be more there than American critics have been able to see.
Well, Noel, when you were still teaching it in Mississippi, of the 20 books on this list that is out there for people to take a gander at, how many of those were on your required reading list for your students?
For my Southern Lit class,
yeah.
I would start off with Wright's Black Boy and Eudora Welty's One Writer's Beginnings. To talk about. I tried to imagine that they were in Jackson for a lot of the same time, several mm-hmm. years early on. I tried to get my students to imagine them on Capitol Street meeting each other, and what kinds of things might be going on, whether mm-hmm. Richard and his mother would have got off the sidewalk or something to help them pass. Then I would go to the Last Gentleman, Walker Percy. Mm-hmm. Several of the books that are on that list. Cain, okay. in my 20th century class.
Now that's interesting that you include Cain.
No, it really is, because when you think about influence, however we interpret influence, and you think about a book like Cain, where do you trace that trajectory of influence if you do?
Right.
Somebody put it on the list. I think somebody put that on the list along with Native Son and Beloved and Invisible mm-hmm. Man. Because they felt as if in the 21st century, we should have at least some representative African-American texts on there. I think you can understand much more of why Their Eyes Watching God is on, or The Color Purple. But Cain, it gets to be kind of questionable as to what people might have been thinking, and certainly with Native Son and Invisible Man.
Yeah, with Cain, I put it on there because I teach the 20th century lit course, American lit course, as a course in narrative rather than in the 20th century novel. And so I'm interested in the modernist notion of the world as fragmented.
Yes, that
so
works well.
So As I Lay Dying, Godan Moses, Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg
as,
and Eudora Welty's the Golden Apples as being sort of an attempt to show the world as it fragments out from our own experience mm-hmm. of it, rather than as a coherent whole, which is what you get in more traditional narratives.
But I still want to think about Invisible Man and why that could remotely be considered a Southern novel. Mm. A lot of people are insistent about Invisible Man, and you say, okay, maybe the first couple of chapters would fit, and then he takes off to New York. But on the other hand, Raphael was born in Oklahoma.
Right.
Well, Southern Living would say that's part of the South.
they would, but what I like to point out is that Sherwood Anderson spent about, 25 or 30 years in Virginia. And wrote a number of books there, but nobody wants to talk about him as a Southern writer.
As a Southern writer, and Toni Morrison certainly has ancestral roots in the South, with her parents having come from Georgia and Alabama, if I remember correctly. But you know, she grew up in Lorain, Ohio, and certainly, I think you could make a better case for Beloved fitting. With his focus on slavery and the aftermath of slavery mm-hmm. and black-white relationships. But Invisible Man, it's hard.
This is Walter Edgar's Journal. Today's program is a rebroadcast of my 2009 conversation with Trudier Harris and the late Noel Polk. The conversation was a preview of a debate on the topic, what was the most influential Southern novel of the 20th century, which aired on SCETV's Take on the South. This encore is a part of our continuing series, Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
Well, there's an interesting South kind of story about Gene Toomer, and that is, for a little over a year, he was an out-of-town member of the South Carolina Poetry Society in the 1920s. And they mm-hmm. published an annual yearbook, and they asked members to send in their, they published anything. That was when the all-white Poetry Society in Charleston realized that they had an African-American member from Washington, D.C. He was not taken from the rolls, but he was also not sent a renewal.
But that's also a commentary on this whole issue of Southerness and Southern lit yes. and all of that. Because if you look at photographs of Gene Toomer, you're looking at a white man.
Well, that was one of that was one of his great struggles.
Yes. And, you know, a mixed race person who just happened to be claimed as Negro. And it is a fascinating commentary on this whole history. And I was thinking specifically about just having reread Faulkner's Delta Autumn and the very, very end of that narrative when Isaac McCaslin encounters the young girl, I mean, the young woman mm-hmm. who's had the mixed race child. And she looks absolutely white. And then he immediately recognizes, because her mother takes in washing, oh, my God, she's not white, and labels her accordingly. And that's one of the issues that so many of these texts take up, and that is this whole idea of racial mixture in the South and what constitutes whiteness, what constitutes blackness, and why it matters in terms of caste and class. So Toomer should not have been classified as a black person. Why should he have been classified as black any more than he was could have been classified as white?
Until just recently, the mixed race, thanks to Joe Christmas, largely, and others, of course, has been a problem, a kind of defining problem of racial discourse. And I wonder what you think of Natasha Trethewey, who instead of being ashamed of it or worried about it or fixated on it, glories in being mixed blood.
It's interesting that you should mention that, because my graduate seminar just did Native Guard 2 weeks ago, and I brought photographs of Natasha to class. I met her about 5 years ago, I guess, in Birmingham, Alabama. And you're correct. I mean, she talks about, okay, my white father, my black mother, and many of the poems in Native Guard have to do with her attitudes towards the South, and specifically towards Mississippi, where she says this land that called her, you know, a half-breed and a whole bunch of other names. But she also says this land of magnolias, this land where they'll bury me.
Right.
And the claiming of that ancestry. And I think, as you point out, in the 21st century, one can be comfortable in doing that, because the African-American black part of it is not so stigmatized as it was when Gene Toomer was around in the 1920s and thereafter. And that, as we recognize again, all the migration into the South, all the different racial ethnic groups in the South, whether they're the Melungeons or the Native Americans or the Chinese in Mississippi or the Japanese, various other places, in addition to all the traditional strands of black and white, then.
And of course, part of that Gene Toomer story, looking back at the list, is his Washington had become segregated largely because of a book written on this list, The Klansman, which was turned into the movie Birth of a Nation, and Woodrow Wilson deciding it was time to segregate the nation's capital.
Yeah.
Until Wilson, public facilities in the nation's capital were by law open to everybody.
Open to everybody.
Let me go back to Natasha Trethewey for just a minute and ask you, true to your...
Would you please identify her for our listeners who might not?
Natasha Trethewey won the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry in 2007 with a volume called Native Guard. She was born in Mississippi and is now the Phyllis Wheatley Distinguished Professor of Poetry at Emory University.
Right. I was going to ask you if there are others like her who are forming a cadre of folks who are going to influence the future of literature.
I don't have names that I can provide, but what is happening now in terms of African-American literary creativity, or if we should call it that, given Natasha, what we were just talking about, is a group of folks who identify themselves as being cultural mulattoes.
Really?
Yes, and these folks then assert that they can draw on any traditions, they will embrace anything, and incorporate anything into their works that they want, and they don't feel as if they must bear the burden of race, or when they treat race, that is not a burden for them in the way that it might have been for their ancestors. Because if you consider Natasha's second volume, Baloxophilia, which is based on the photographs that this photographer took of prostitutes
in New Orleans.
Mm-hmm. And she looked at one of these photographs and said, oh my, look at that, the little frown between her eyes. Look at this woman who is visibly white.
Mm-hmm.
And what would the life of this person have been like? But all of these prostitutes were mixed race,
mm-hmm.
women who were visibly white, but who were known legally to be black.
Yeah.
And so could be used in these ways.
And then, of course, I mean, just as Mr. Plessy from Louisiana was visibly white, but was labeled by Louisiana law as African American.
Isn't it just crazy how far people went back in those days to find a little drop, as somebody says, the mighty drop of black blood so that they could label folks in this direction?
What has been important to whites is that difference. What the ending of Absalom, I think, suggests is that we are terrified. I mean, you would think that the argument there that Shreve makes at the end is that one of these days difference is going to be ironed out, and so that even the whitest person will one day look at you and say, I have sprung from the loins of African kings. And I think that's what he's actually saying, and that's what terrifies Quentin, is that we're all got that blood. And you would think that having that difference ironed out and taken away would simplify things and make it all right.
You would think. I mean, that's what Gene Toomer thought, and then some of the essays he wrote, that one day there's going to be such an intermarriage and intermixture that this concern or these concerns about race will just disappear. We'll all just be American. Mm-hmm. And even Charles Chestnut, to some extent, was hopeful of that.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, that's not been the case.
But that's why Quentin is so terrified, I think, at the end of Absalom.
Yeah.
He said, I don't hate it. I don't hate it.
Yeah. Desperate attempt.
I had a colleague suggest, let's everybody get a DNA test, then we'll find out who's kin to whom. And, of course, South Carolinians have begun exploring that, whether it's Edward Ball, Slaves in the Family. That was just the first of a number of mm-hmm. such efforts. Felicia Furman, who is descended from William Gilmore Sims, mm-hmm. has been doing the same thing with the black and white individuals who've lived on the Sims plantation down there in the Lowcountry. I worked with Felicia on a project. She did a film. One of the Sims family lore is that they did not ever go to the quarters. You know, that was one of William Gilmore Sims' rules. We know he did not purchase any slaves after 1850. Well, in the 1850 census, the slaves are all listed. But in the 1860 census, they're five mulattoes. And if they didn't purchase any, where did they come from?
Exactly.
Now, there were nephews and what have you. I'm certainly not saying that Sims himself, but the story was that this never happened. Well, obviously, it did.
And isn't that, going back to what we mentioned way, way earlier, exoticism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's forbidden becomes attractive.
We have unfortunately run out of time. Let's have sort of a last word, if you will, on defining influence. Noel, you look at influence in terms of influence on other writers. You mentioned particularly those in Latin America.
Yeah, I think that Faulkner's influence on other writers is essential to 20th century literature worldwide for technical reasons and political and historical reasons.
Okay. And Trudy, you looked at influence more in a broader cultural sense.
Yes.
Books being taught.
Read. And that involves an international component as well, how widely the books get out, what they do, especially outside the South, in terms of changing perceptions people may have of the South.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we can find a text that does that kind of work and can be documented doing that kind of work, then that's a different kind of influence that's probably more outside the academy, mm-hmm. but I think it's just as significant.
All right. Well, Trudia Harris and Noel Pope, thanks for being with us today on The Journal.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah.
It's been fun.
This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. It's good to have Professor Noel Polk and Professor Trudier Harris in the studio, but also wonderful the way the conversation went. When you deal with the American South and you deal with fiction or history, there are certain central questions that are always going to be there. We went from talking about Southern fiction to contemporary Southern poetry and the phrase that Professor Harris used, individuals who now claim to be cultural mulattoes, drawing on all aspects of the region's culture. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of the Journal.
Today's program was a rebroadcast of my 2009 conversation with Trudier Harris and the late Noel Polk. The conversation was a preview of a debate on the topic, What was the most influential Southern novel of the 20th century, which aired on SCETV's Take on the South. This encore is part of our continuing series, Walter Edgar's Journal at 21.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETB Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.